You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eric Altman was on our show this past April to talk about collaborating with Kevin Mattson on a book called The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. It traces the rise, changing conceptions, and missteps of the liberal political movement in the United States. And we thought that we would re-air that conversation for you as we celebrate the 4th of July. I began by asking Eric Altman, how did this 19th century concept of liberalism change so much in this country?
I think it's gone through three evolutions, or two evolutions and one invention. Liberalism, originally, classical liberalism, simply means that it's the spirit of the Enlightenment. It means human men and women have the ability to think for themselves, to reason for themselves, ought to be allowed to speak freely about their thinking and reasoning, and should act upon that thinking and reasoning, as opposed to acting on what the word of God, quote-unquote, may be, or the word of kings might be, or any form of historical like a dictatorship of the proletariat, something that is outside of human reason. So most people believe that, at least they did until recently. It's something that both Ronald Reagan and Barney Frank can agree on. Maybe Margaret Thatcher is a better example than Ronald Reagan, but a lot of American conservatives would agree with that.
But not George Bush, you're suggesting.
Not George Bush, but Milton Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
Then liberalism, American liberalism in the New Deal.
Well, in England, the liberals wound up being the party between the conservatives and labor. So it became the middle of the road party.
Right. Well, actually, in most countries, the Democratic Party in the United States would be the conservative party, just because our politics is so much located further to the right. I would argue in large measure because of the way we allow money to operate in our system. But we can get to that later. In the 1920s and 30s, liberalism transformed itself because it's the theoretical aspects of liberalism were not consistent anymore with the real-world aspects of liberalism. In other words, you might have had theoretical freedom to choose what you wanted to do with your life and where you wanted to work, but the powers of big business and other forces were so strong that it didn't really mean anything. And so during the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt came to represent what he called militant liberalism. And that was the idea that that common people, the poor, the middle class, working people, needed the government on their side to equalize the battle that they were facing in economic life. And that became the guiding creed of American politics, really, until Ronald Reagan became president.
And Keynesian economics became almost...
that was the manner in which it did it. It didn't have to be Keynesian. It could have been something else. But it became associated with Keynesian economics. That was the theory because American liberals were not socialists. They didn't believe in taking over the means of production of the economy.
Especially since after World War II, the Cold War forced any liberals in this country to really distance themselves from words like socialist.
Right. But socialism, the most socialist party ever, most votes it ever got in this country was in 1912 under Eugene Victor Debs, who was then jailed by Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat. And that was just under a million votes. Socialism really never took off in this country. There are good historical reasons for that, but I think you would have had Keynesianism rather than socialism without a Cold War, in other words.
Why do you think liberal has come to be something of a dirty word in recent years, and some people prefer now to call themselves progressives instead?
Well, to get to the third evolution, I think it's consistent with the answer to that question. In the 1960s, liberalism transformed itself again. And following the civil rights movement, all kinds of groups of people felt that they needed the government on their side to fight discrimination and to give them a leg up because of historic discrimination. And so cultural and social liberalism became, I would say, overwhelmed economic liberalism in liberal politics. And that played a role in allowing the conservatives to demonize liberalism, which they have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in doing, by arguing that liberalism isn't really about the common good anymore, which people understood it to be under Roosevelt and Truman, but is now just about doling out benefits to special groups who have access to them, special elites, whether they be blacks or women or handicapped people or professors or public radio stations. And so they've been able
to... The real elites in America.
Yeah, teachers. So they've been able to redefine the word so effectively that most liberals have abandoned it.
And you write, I'm quoting, in Obama's America and Cuomo's New York, liberalism was primarily a movement designed to increase social and cultural freedom for those who could afford to enjoy them.
Well, the second part of this equation, aside from the demonization of the word liberal, which has been going on now for over 30 years, is the takeover of our politics by money. And together with the collapse of the union movement, particularly the private union movement, which now accounts for fewer than 1 in 12 workers in this country, our politics runs on money, and the Democrats had to find money to get elected. That's the job of a political politician, to get elected. So they went where the money was. And people with money don't like to pay high taxes to support other people. And so these people, they have progressive cultural views. They support gay marriage and women's right to choose, and they definitely support an open immigration policy, and they don't really feel a need to carry around guns and so forth. They're urban, educated elites.
What you're calling cultural liberalism.
Yeah, and so that's a much easier sell.
Than economic liberalism.
Right. And so the people who are paying for the thing are not... I mean, you saw this when Obama had to throw in the towel on the Bush tax cuts, that a lot of Democratic funders liked the Bush tax cuts. But, even though they're terribly unfair and bad for the country.
But President Obama passed a number of pieces of major social legislation in the first 2 years of his administration, including the Affordable Care Act, what has been called Obamacare, the Frank Dodd Financial Regulation Bill, which created the Consumer Protection Agency. Isn't that a sign that some forms of economic liberalism still exist and have popularity, at least in some quarters?
I don't think those were liberal measures. I think the liberal measures were left on the table. I think we weren't even able to discuss single-payer health care. Obama gave up on the public option with regard to health care. So he passed a bill which was economically neutral in the near term for the government. So that's not a liberal measure. That's a technocratic measure.
But he also had the experience of the Clinton approach to health care reform. And obviously was trying to avoid it. So he winds up coming up with something that the Conservative Heritage Foundation devised, at least parts of it, the individual mandate, and right. Then winds up being vilified by the Heritage Foundation for doing it.
Well, this is part of my argument that liberals should be noisier and prouder and more militantly liberal, because it doesn't really matter how much they try and concede to the other side, they're still going to be called these names. And progressives are foolish to pretend that they're not liberals as well. In fact, most centrists in this country are actually liberals. They don't like the word liberal because it's been so vilified. And so when you do public opinion polls, only 1 in 5 Americans cops to the label. But then you ask them what they think the government should do, and they're all liberal positions, you know, moderates speaking, centrists. So you're right that that Obama did end up caving, and he didn't get any credit for it from the media or from the right. So why cave?
My guest is Eric Alterman, who's a professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College in CUNY, and he writes a column for the Nation. He has written with the help. His name is in smaller type than yours. So
he drafted a rough draft, but I wrote every word in the final draft. So
Kevin Mattson, a professor of contemporary history at the University of Ohio. Do you think that the financial crisis and the recession has shifted the views of Americans on the role that the government should play in correcting problems in the economy?
I thought it would, but it hasn't. In fact, it's shifted it. If it shifted it, it shifted it to the right rather than to the left. I was under the impression, the misimpression, I was under two misimpressions in 2008. One was that Barack Obama believed strongly in what he was saying in the campaign and that he would fight for it. And number two, that the...
He promised a new politics.
Well, new politics, but he promised a whole set of policies that he then let slide by the wayside. But I also made a miscalculation that the banking industry and the housing industry were similarly discredited by the crisis that they caused, the way that big business had been in the New Deal, which allowed people to see we really need to address these problems. But in fact, they came back the next day with their lobbies and their funding, and they were just as strong as ever. And so they were able to resist all the things they really felt they needed to resist in terms of the new legislation. And so Obama, his whole shtick, it turns out, is to take whatever deal is on the table, not to fight for a better deal.
Although he has been pushing for the whole matter of income inequality. And
I am so deeply unimpressed
rule.
With Obama's rhetoric now. I've been fooled once. You only get to fool me once. And I heard all this great rhetoric in 2008. I sat down and had dinner with the guy in 2005, and I was snowed like I've never been snowed by a politician in my life.
He is very impressive. He was a guest on the show.
Yeah, he's magnificent.
Speaks in paragraphs.
He's a normal person when he talks, and he's intelligent, and he responds to what you say. And it's there are very few other politicians I've ever met like him in my 52 long years. But I was sold a bill of goods, and part of it was that I was listening to what he said too carefully, and that's a mistake with a politician. It's a mistake with any politician, and he is a politician.
But from his advisor's point of view. If I think one of them even said something like, it's not who you're voting for, but what the alternative is. And the assumption is on the right that people are going to vote for Mitt Romney, even though they don't love the man. And on the left, people like you are going to vote for Barack Obama because the alternative is somebody that you wouldn't accept.
Yes. Well, my friend Bruce Springsteen and I agree that whereas we're not as enthusiastic as we were in 2008, we definitely have no problem supporting this president over any available alternative. But it's going to be a problem for Obama because a lot of what he had going in 2008 was enthusiasm and turnout. And he's not going to get that this time. And I don't know exactly how he's going to do it. I mean, the question is has he reassured conservatives enough so that they're not going to turn out against him? Because he's certainly not going to turn out young people and first-time voters the way he did the first time.
Well, do you think that economic liberalism in the United States is dead for the foreseeable future, or nearly dead, or that the Occupy Wall Street movement suggests that it's just going to take on a new face?
I don't think Occupy Wall Street people are liberals. Which is okay. They don't have to be liberals, but that's not where I'd look to revive.
So what are they? They've been critical of the
corporate culture.
I think
they're leftist anti-liberals the same way the new left was anti-liberal. Doesn't mean liberals can't cooperate with these people. It doesn't mean it's not a good thing for liberalism, but I don't think they're liberals. But I'll tell you, to answer your first question, do I think liberalism's dead? No, it's not dead. But nationally speaking, polls consistently show that between 15 at most 20%, but right now I think the last number we saw was 17%. Of Americans say that the government can be trusted to do the right thing most or all of the time. You can't have liberalism with that number. You can't have liberalism without a strong central government. So you have to build that number back up to 50% at least. And until you do that, then liberalism will just be a matter of pockets in, you know, big cities and college towns.
My guest is Eric Alterman, who's written with Kevin Mattson, The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. It's published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had in April with Eric Alterman at Brooklyn College and The Nation. He was here to discuss his book, The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. I opened the second part of our conversation by saying that I guess he wasn't surprised by some of the details that have emerged about President Obama's attempt to strike a deal on the national debt with House Speaker John Boehner last summer. A lot of the things that liberals consider inviolable were put on the table.
Yeah, I actually was surprised. My naivete knows no bounds. You know, I wrote a book last year called Kabuki Democracy, published by Nation Books, where I argued that the system made it impossible for Obama to keep the promises he had made as a candidate, the liberal promises, because the system was so dysfunctional and driven by money. But once I started seeing the deal that he made first on the debt to make the debt payments, and then the deal that he offered John Boehner, it really shocked me, I have to say. This is much further. This is not a president who wants to see as his legacy the restoration of economic equality or opportunity even. It's a president who wants to put America's fiscal house in order first and foremost. And I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake from the standpoint of the well-being of the country. And I also think it's not what we elected him to do.
But you're right that by 2011, the president was forced to begin the dismantlement of some of the most significant accomplishments of the New Deal and the Great Society.
Felt forced. Yeah. Well, I didn't know what I wrote, but that's what I feel. Yeah, he did do. He did. He has been doing that, and he tried to do it even further than he succeeded in doing. So
and yet,
far.
They still call him a socialist.
Exactly. What is the point of trying to make deals with these people, of trying to kowtow to these people, when they are driven by an ideology which is entirely divorced from reality?
Now, you begin your study of liberalism with Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
With the death of Franklin Roosevelt, yeah.
And that's because you felt that he represented the ideal version of liberalism as far as you're concerned?
Well,
I mean, you could have gone back to Teddy Roosevelt, couldn't you?
The book is long enough as it is. But no, the contemporary version of liberalism that we understand to be liberalism began with Franklin Roosevelt, number one. Number two, you know, the thing about liberalism, another word for liberalism in America is whatever works. And that was Roosevelt's idea. He was an anti-ideologue. He was nothing like. In that sense, liberalism is not an ideology. It's a way of approaching things. But you can go back and forth. You can change your mind in liberalism. That's what Roosevelt did.
Do you think he was better at selling the country on liberal economic policies than other presidents have?
He was better at selling the country on everything than other presidents.
Now, why is that? He had that patrician style. Barack Obama talks to people as though he's one of us. And he also was accused of being a little too golden-tongued during the campaign, and yet he hasn't been able to sell any of his policies.
Well, that's a very big question. First of all, it's a different world. America of 1933 is a very different world than today's. There was no Fox News. There was no conservative Borg. There was no one. It's true the newspapers didn't support Roosevelt in those days, but there wasn't this constant barrage of calling him all these kinds of names, saying a Muslim, saying he's not part of this country, just having to get to reality to begin to discuss things. And secondly, people were much more deferential in those days, so having a patrician president made a lot more sense. Since the president said something, people tended to believe it and accept it in a way that they don't today.
If Barack Obama dug in his heels, would that matter at all?
And one more thing, money wasn't nearly as powerful as it is today. So the economic interests that he was fighting were not nearly as – it wasn't as much of a fight.
At one point, let's talk about digging in your heels, which you're kind of suggesting might have been an alternative approach. He would have still lost everything, wouldn't he, because Congress is – even the Senate, which has a Democratic majority – he can't get any legislation through.
You know, you might remember in 2008 there was a flap when Barack Obama said that he admired the way Ronald Reagan had transformed the discourse with new ideas. And Hillary Clinton said, oh, he likes Reagan. Isn't this terrible? But he didn't say he liked Reagan. He said he admired the way the man transformed the discourse. Where was that president? The one who came out and transformed the discourse. What Ronald Reagan achieved in 1981 was considered unthinkable before he proposed it. And yet Barack Obama didn't try. Now, to be fair to Barack Obama, he would say, hey, we had this economic crisis. Things were collapsing. And in fact, it turns out the economic crisis was worse than any of us imagined. We were losing, production had fallen by 3.9%, it turns out, instead of 1.9% as people thought. So we were in a real crisis, and they didn't have the opportunity to change the way business was done. But there are a lot of chances that he's foregone because he doesn't want to pick a fight. Even when he defends his program, he says, you've heard it over and over, he says, this is not class warfare, this is math, Well, it is class warfare. They're fighting a class warfare against liberals, against the middle class and the poor. And it's just a matter of fighting back, of taking up your side. But Barack Obama doesn't think he has a side. And that's really my essential conflict with the way he governs.
Do you think that FDR altered Americans' basic ideas of what their rights were? At one point, didn't he even, near the end of his presidency, call for a new Bill of Rights?
That second Bill of Rights is the best, most progressive document any major politician has ever proposed in American history. And it's the unfinished agenda of liberalism.
Because it didn't go anywhere. In fact, when Harry Truman tried a little bit of to propose a little bit of that legislation, it all died.
Right. It started going back. Well,
the right to have a job, for example.
Yeah, it means – and housing and so forth. Yeah, it means a fight with big business. But it turns out that fighting big business is like fighting the water, because business and rich people are what pay for our politics. So – essentially, what has to happen is we have to find a way to control money in politics.
There was also the image factor there. FDR actually was seen as a kind of a break on the full tilt liberalism of his wife.
Yeah, I don't know how important that was. I mean, there's no question that a lot of people felt that FDR saved capitalism from a potentially much more revolutionary situation. People felt that at the time. Some historians have argued it. My dissertation advisor, Barton J. Bernstein, was actually famous for making this argument. I don't buy it. I think Roosevelt tried whatever worked.
You say he kind of employed triangulation before.
No,
Bill
I think
Clinton
Roosevelt was fearless. I think he was fearless. I think he did whatever he thought would work, and he didn't care who liked it or who didn't. And that's actually what liberals need more than anything, is the self-confidence to be fearless.
My guest is Eric Alterman. His book, The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism, From Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama, published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. At the end of World War II, the United States was the most powerful country in the world. And yet we had the rise of McCarthyism. You would have thought that we were seriously threatened and any day would be inundated by the Red Horde.
Yeah, well, as I said, a lot of American liberalism today reflects that period still.
Well, Hubert Humphrey, didn't he introduce a bill that would have made membership in the Communist Party punishable by 5 years in prison?
He did.
Mr. Liberal.
He did. He has a very dishonorable history in that regard. But the point I wanted to make is that the right in America has always to some degree reflected its own psychosis, its own fears that have no relationship to reality. McCarthy never unearthed a single communist. And yet liberals have never had the courage to say, do your worst. Go to it. We'll stand up. And so liberals have always been trying to give away a little bit of the store in the idea that they'll be allowed to like live in the back room. And the thing to do is to stand up for your beliefs, because people respect that even if they don't agree with you.
Were you surprised by Representative Alan West's recent assertion that around 80 Democratic members of Congress are members of the Communist Party?
I'm not surprised. But I'll tell you what the problem is. Why is this being reported like it's worth knowing? I mean, the guy is clearly a lunatic.
But he's a member of Congress.
So what? He's not an important member of Congress. And also, if I mean, this is exactly the same thing that happened with McCarthy, although, of course, with McCarthy, it was more damaging. But these people say these things, and then the congressmen and then the media report them without pointing out that they're nonsense. And so they get a life of their own. I mean, Michelle Bachmann, I'll give you a perfect example. Michelle Bachmann, during the campaign, she said the HPV vaccine made a friend of her kids, someone she met, mentally retarded. So that's nonsense. It's just complete nonsense. But how many people are not going to get the vaccine now and will experience the disease because the media simply report this as nonsense over and over and over? Newt Gingrich says the craziest things over and over, as did, what's his name? Who just – Santorum. Santorum said that no California public university teaches American history anymore. Nonsense. Every single one does. The only example he had was a medical college. He didn't know that it was a medical college. And yet, no doubt, these public university system in California will suffer because people believe this nonsense. And the media, because for a lot of reasons, I've written books about that too, they report this stuff without challenging it. And we need the media have been so cowed by the right, just as liberals have, that they give a free pass to this right wing lies and nonsense.
You write perhaps the most interesting case in liberal Hollywood of the period was, we're talking about the McCarthy period, was that of the director Ilya Kazan.
It is interesting.
But why pick that one? There were so many people who were blacklisted, others named names.
You know, I think that the whole blacklist is more complicated than most people do. My friend and some degree mentor, Victor Navasky, wrote a book called Naming Names, which is a terrific book, which I recommend. But I have a slightly different view because communists wouldn't tell the truth during this period. One of the few things I agree with about Irving Kristol is he said if they had just said, look, I'm a communist, go ahead and prosecute me if you want to prosecute me for what I truly believe, it would have been easy to defend them. But they were lying. And they were, at the same time that they were lying, they were trying to take over these liberal organizations without admitting what they were doing. So liberals were being asked to defend their own enemies who wouldn't tell the truth about themselves. It was a very difficult situation. And Kazan, who, you know, I don't think he did the right thing by naming names, but he had worked with the communists, with these communists who had betrayed him and had shown him who they were. And he didn't want to lose his job to defend people who he thought were lousy people and couldn't be trusted. And I have some sympathy for that position.
You suggested earlier that the media has just allowed itself to be cowed. Should they be refuting instead of just reporting?
Yes.
Well, don't they wind up becoming exactly what they're accused of being, which is advocates for a certain position?
Well, there was a flap recently where the New York Times ombudsman wrote an article saying that it wasn't the job of the reporter to correct the source when the source was saying something that was false. And then a lot of people said, this is crazy. What do you mean? The job of the media ought to be truth. And I'm not really so interested in how you get to that truth, you know, whether it's quote unquote objective or not, or whether or not you bring in expert sources or your own expertise. I mean, I'm really lucky because I write in the opinion media and I can just tell you what I think is true. And if you challenge me, I'll give you my evidence. And if I have room, I try to present my evidence. But the job of the media ought to be to present the actual evidence and let people decide whether or not they want to act on it. And in our media, it's considered, if someone lies on one of the Sunday shows, the host, not even the reporter, the host might say, well, is that really true? What about X? And then the person will repeat their lie, and that'll be the end of it. It's bad manners to say, but wait, aren't you lying? And what about, doesn't this prove that you're lying? I once watched an interview on the BBC by a man named Jonathan Dimbleby, and he was interviewing Donald Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld was lying. And the guy wouldn't let the lie go. And it went on for like 40 minutes. And Rumsfeld had never experienced anything like it because he was used to this cowed media. And that's, I think, an idea of what the media ought to be.
Isn't a turning point in the fate of respect for the liberals, LBJ's presidency? Because on the one hand, he gave us the Great Society, major pieces of social and civil rights legislation that transformed the country. But he's remembered as the man who got us into Vietnam.
Well, the LBJ, as people will be talking about pretty soon when the fourth volume of Robert Caro's book comes out. My view of LBJ and the view I argue about in this book is that while he was brave in a lot of ways, he was a coward in the following respect. He was willing to go to Vietnam and to destroy his presidency, which he knew he was doing, because he was so afraid of allowing a discussion on Vietnam to take place. He could have resisted going into Vietnam at the time. Richard Russell told him not to go. Hubert Humphrey told him not to go. McGeorge Bundy said, this can go either way, but you don't have to do it. And yet, he knew that if he went, liberals would stay quiet because they would support him for a while, and the conservatives would be on his side. And he was so afraid of having to fight with the conservatives, of having a public debate, that he did this thing which he knew would end terribly. And you really do need thousands of pages of Robert Caro to understand why he was so afraid of that. But But he did destroy all of his achievements. And actually, people say, well, we tried liberalism and it failed. And there were quite a few failures, but we never really tried it because Vietnam swallowed it up.
But then every president, a Democrat, since has not been a liberal in the old sense.
Right, because liberalism it appears to have been discredited by Johnson's presidency, and yet it wasn't really tried. Which is not to say that I'm not very critical of a lot of things Johnson did and the liberals did. They made terrible mistakes, particularly with regard to race and integration. But
what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that
wasn't his civil rights legislation one of his major achievements?
I'm all with him up through the civil rights legislation. It's the means by which the civil rights agenda was implemented that I have a lot of trouble with and that I think has been a disaster for liberalism. I mean, to say to your most important political constituency, white working class people, you are going to pay the price for the historic wrongs that have been visited upon these people. And the people who are insisting on this price are not going to pay the price. And if you disagree with us, you're a racist. Well, that's a formula for catastrophe, and that's the catastrophe that was visited upon liberalism.
Earlier this month in The Nation, you wrote, it's a truism that conservatives are tougher than liberals. It's also true.
Did I write that? That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, cliches are true for a reason, you know. They are tougher. Conservatives are they're taking a whole host of unpopular positions.
But
and they don't care.
Andrew Breitbart, I don't want to speak ill of the dead.
I do.
Okay, well, you can. But he...
What's the date where you can start speaking ill of the dead? Because you will speak ill of a lot of dead people. It's just that Breitbart died like a month ago.
He continued to be seen as a major power broker, despite the fact that he was caught again and again fudging the facts.
The conservative media don't care about facts. I mean, some conservatives care about facts, and there are a lot of conservatives I admire, most of them historically. But the conservative media today is not interested in facts. Facts are something to be undermined. I know that, and it doesn't bother me. Like I said, I've written books about that. What I object to is the way that the mainstream media have capitulated to that. That they it's like science is now a left-wing idea. And telling the truth, sticking to the truth, is entirely fungible. And that's a great victory for Breitbart and his fellow, I don't know what to call
him. One more question before you go from a listener. He wonders, or she wonders, what liberals can do to reinvigorate the movement, especially given the role of money that you just described and all the power of the conservative super PACs.
Well, that's a very big question. I'm glad I wrote a book that explains how we got here from there. But you're right to focus on those on that. Money has to be taken on. The Supreme Court has to be pressured. But in the meantime, since that's going to take a very long time, the first step would be to fight for public funding of our elections.
Well, that's unlikely, Eric.
That's an answer, though.
Eric Alterman, his latest book, The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism, from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama, published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.